Hear ye!
Hear ye! Hear ye! The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. We're delighted to welcome you here this morning. I'm especially delighted to welcome two student groups. We have Catholic Central High School of Burlington. Would those students please stand? Thank you. You may be seated. And we have Badger High School. Would those students stand, please? I think you outnumber Catholic Central High School. Well, welcome to you all. The students are here with us with a program that is sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. The program is called Court with Class, and we invite students from all over the state to join us for an oral argument. If the school accepts our invitation, the students are given briefs and do various studies about the case that they will hear. And also, as a part of the program, the students meet with a justice after the second oral argument during the lunch hour. The presentation at that time relates to the procedure that the court uses in the hearing and deciding cases, not the substance of the case. You are all invited to join the students for the noon presentation. And today, the noon presentation will be by the justice on my farthest left, Justice Patience Rogensack. And I'll introduce the rest of the court to you. Seated next to Justice Rogensack is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox. And to his right, Justice Patrick Crooks. The chair on the far right is generally occupied by Justice Sykes. She will not be here today. With these preliminary matters taken care of, I will call the first case, 02-1249, St. Paul Fire and Marine Insurance Company versus Curtis J. Kelgan. Arguing for Mr. Kelgan is Philip Kadra. Counsel?
May it please the court, Madam Chief Justice, and members of the court. My name is Phil Todrick, and I represent Curtis Kelchin. Curtis, my client, is an autistic, mentally retarded, childlike individual who went to work at the sheltered workshop at the Career Development Center in Eau Claire. And while there, he was repeatedly raped in the men's room when he went to use the toilet. He was raped by an individual with a long history of sexually assaultive conduct, which history was known to the Career Development Center. When the assaults were discovered, he left CDC and never applied for any workman's compensation benefits. This action was commenced by St. Paul Insurance seeking a declaration that workman's compensation were my client's sole and exclusive remedy for the injuries which occurred. Later, CDC and its insurers asked the trial court to stay all trial court proceedings pending a determination by the department concerning the rights and benefits due to my client under the Act. Curtis objected, having never applied for any such benefits. Nonetheless, the court ordered the parties to go to the department and place the burden upon CDC and its insurers to commence proceedings there, which is possible by what's known as a reverse application. The statute allows any party in interest to bring an action before the department. At the same hearing, the trial court, as I said, required the CDC to file the application. Now, Curtis's claims are brought under the Patient's Rights Statute, 51.61. This is a remedial statute. Its remedial nature is apparent by the very substantial remedies created by the legislature, which include make-whole damages. Under the language of the statute, a patient whose rights are violated is entitled to recover, quote, any damages as may be proved. In addition, the patient can recover exemplary damages, reasonable and actual attorney's fees. The legislature was so intent on making these remedies meaningful that it even waived sovereign immunity with respect to claims brought under patients' rights. These remedies demonstrate the importance with which the legislature placed upon protecting those most vulnerable among us, the disabled. In this case, demonstrates the wisdom of that legislation. Obviously, CDC did little or nothing to protect Curtis, my client. They hired and placed a known sexual predator in the sheltered workshop, a man who was on parole for other sexual assaults. They failed to supervise this gentleman adequately, imposed restrictions upon his movement about the facility, but did not enforce their own restrictions. And then they failed to even advise its own staff of the dangerous propensities of the individual walking around the sheltered workshop.
Counselor, could I interrupt you just a minute? It's your contention that your client is a patient within the meaning of 5161, right?
Yes.
And I understand that CDC claims they're an employer. If your client is a patient, is there another designation other than employer that you would apply to CDC under Chapter 51?
Yes, a provider of services to the developmentally disabled.
Okay, so they wear two hats, according to your argument, and one of the hats is as a provider of services, and it's with that hat on that you are seeking damages under Chapter 51?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
And that is clear from a combination of the opening language of 51.61 sub 1, which defines patient in very broad terms, and 51.437, which defines developmental disability services and expressly includes sheltered employment.
Mr. Todrick, that's really a dual persona type of approach, is that correct?
Well, I made that argument in front of the Court of Appeals. I lost. I have not pursued that argument in this court. I have thoughts about that, but I must honestly say I did not pursue it here. The dual persona decision in front of the Court of Appeals, I did not ask for review.
But the answer that you gave to Justice Rogensack would seem to resurrect that argument. You're not making that argument?
Again, I would like to. If the court would allow me to, I would. The dual persona is extremely restrictive. The case law in that regard is extremely restrictive. And in this case, when the statutory language is so clear, and where my client is so clearly a patient within the statute, I decided, under the guise of limiting the issues before this court, to not bring that issue before the court.
Well, do you dispute at all that CDC is an employer?
No. Technically, it's an employer. Work comp applies, but it's an employer, an unusual type. My client's wage was $20.70 per week. It was an employer in form only.
Well, how do you get over the barriers of the WCA being the exclusive remedy and then also the double recovery barrier? It seems to me those are your real problems here.
Yes, and the Court of Appeals ruled in my favor on one and against me on the other. This is really a case about two statutes. And Byers versus LIRC states how one deals with two statutes when they both might apply to the same set of circumstances. One has to look at them both, and none of these questions can be answered by looking just at the WCA or just at the patient's rights statute. And in that case, the Court of Appeals correctly concluded, I believe, that the exclusive remedy provision does not bar these claims because it would defeat the purpose of these claims.
My question, Justice Crooks just alluded to the double recovery. So you, your client recovered, $10,000, and as I recall, about $4,000 was for medical?
Past medical.
Past medical. And what was the remaining $6,000 for?
$317 were for all of the disability benefits allowed under the Act. The rest, in my mind, were for future treatment for his post-traumatic stress disorder.
So none of it was for pain or suffering?
The Court of Appeals went at length, and the briefs go at length, whether or not pain and suffering is somehow compensated. In my brief, I've argued it's minimally compensated. But the point is, and here's what I meant about having to look at both acts, the patient's rights statute, to vindicate its purpose, allows any damages as may be proven, which is clearly in excess of the limited benefits available under the WCA.
Counsel, are you finished, Justice Brooks? I went through the file as best I could with regard to the double recovery. And I guess the threshold question, as advanced by Justice Crooks, was what was recovered the first time. That's the foundation to know whether or not it's double. And I looked at, as set forth in your appendix, 129 and 30, what was being compensated. Exactly what you said. At 130, we have the compromise agreement, of course, which under was approved, as I understand it. And so what is being requested, and this is also, by the way, consistent with the determination, the interlocutory order of the administrative law judge with regard to jurisdiction and what's being pursued. Referring to Appendix 130 and 131, on 131, it says, just like you said, past medical, future medical, and temporary disability. It says, if I can find it here, specifically, that's what you are requesting.
It also compromised permanent partial disability benefits as well, Justice.
And where did you see that?
It's on AP 131, paragraph B.
Is under workers' comp?
Yes, Justice. It's clear also from the facts of
Let me just ask. In my research on the record, at least with regard to what was said by the hearing examiner, that you were not seeking that. Specifically, you were seeking, as I understood, past and future medical and temporary total disability. Am I wrong on that? I'm looking at Appendix 130. Specifically, and this is what the parties agreed to, specifically the respondent employee alleges entitlement to temporary total disability benefits for August 29, 1995 through March 11, 1996. Did you file an application in this case? I know there was a reverse application.
Yes, we never did.
Okay. The order finding jurisdiction indicates that there are issues regarding compensation, medical expenses, date of injury, and apportionment of liability vis-a-vis the insurance companies. As I said, 130 says that you were claiming, since there's no specific application on file, that you were claiming temporary total disability, past and future medical. And that's what you responded to with regard to Justice Wilcox. Because you didn't file an application, it's an unusual posture, but I want to know what you were claiming.
Well, as I made clear in my briefs, we have no permanent disability benefits under the Act because my client returned to the same employment after his assaults as before. These assaults had no impact upon his earning capacity and his ability to earn. After the PTSD, he took some time off and returned to another sheltered employment where he works today.
And that's precisely my point. You argue that on page 19 of your brief that you've not claimed permanent disability. And this is my focus then. Temporary total disability, as I understand it, is your wage loss claim. In other words, if there's a formula for assessing, if you were off for 5 weeks, you get, subject to the formula, payment for those 5 weeks. It's a reduced formula, something like two-thirds, but that's what you get. It's a wage loss claim. Now, arguably, permanent disability, under the case law as I view it, arguably, under Threshman's, has a pain and suffering component. I don't know if it does. I don't know. But let's say arguably it does. But who can argue that temporary total disability has a pain and suffering component since it's specifically wage loss? It's not earning capacity. And the case law that we have indicates, you know, there's arguments on both sides as to whether or not pain and suffering is a part of loss of earning capacity, which is your permanent disability claim. So how does that all figure? You've never made a claim for permanent disability, only temporary total disability is set forth.
Under the Act, we have no claim for permanent disability because the Act does not compensate it unless it affects ability to earn.
So does pain and suffering, is that involved at all in a payment of past or future medicals?
Only to the extent, and it's measured only by, the $20.70 my client earned on a weekly basis.
That's the wage loss. That's not loss of earning capacity. Loss of earning capacity as it feeds into permanent disability. Is that right? So that surprised me because I thought as the things were brief that we were probably, your claim was for permanent disability.
It is under the patient's rights statute.
Sure, but I'm talking about under Chapter 102. You made no claim, and the documents evince that you made no claim other than medical expenses and temporary total disability, which is wage loss claim.
And that's true. We didn't want to be there. We never applied, never wanted those benefits. By reverse application, we were forced there.
Okay, how'd you get to $10,000?
It was offered, and I thought it was a reasonable compensation based upon the benefits allowable under the Act.
Okay, so you thought that would cover past meds, future meds, wage loss.
Past wage loss.
But the award,
no future wage loss.
The award that resulted from that $10,000 settlement talks in terms of permanent partial disability, does it not?
That was insisted by the insurance company. They want to wipe out all those claims. They wanted a full and comprehensive agreement on all possible work comp claims.
Was that part of the settlement agreement that you accepted?
Well, obviously, yes, in the sense that it was included by the insurance company and we agreed to waive those. And it was easy to waive because we have no future permanent claims because my client returned to work at the same or a better wage.
Okay. Is the $10,000 divided out in any of the settlement or is it lump sum?
Well, it's defined in the settlement agreement. Page is AP 130.
Okay. How much? What does it say? What we're driving at, or I think what we're driving at, is to find out whether in the workers' comp there was any defined amount set aside for paying pain and suffering.
None.
Well, that's the issue, because as I understand Justice Bradley's question and as I understand Justice Crook's question, they agree with you that past meds, no pain and suffering is in there. Future meds, no pain and suffering is there. Temporary total disability, wage loss claim, no pain and suffering. The problem that I hear from them is if this 10 grand was for permanent and partial disability, that in a usual workers' comp case, there is pain and suffering. I mean, that's what I hear. Now, you can correct that at various levels. One, they'll speak for themselves and correct me.
We agree with her.
Stop them.
I disagree with her.
We agree with her.
She has to hear a little more clearly from the side.
That's, as I hear it, the issue.
Well, as I
said, your response is?
As the cases make clear, there is to, in some respect, pain and suffering plays some part in work comp recovery, but only to the extent it affects earnings. The cases are clear on that. That means, like in Szymanski, Szymanski had two injuries, both painful, one of which affected his ability to work, for which he was granted benefits. He had another painful injury, being nervousness and headaches, received nothing. Nothing, because that did not affect his ability to earn. Szymanski is good law. It's cited in scholarly journals, I understand, and it's still the law. It's the law as recognized in work comp circles. So, as I believe, this case is about the relationship between two statutes. We've talked about the work comp angle, and clearly there's important purposes served by the work comp statute. The historic compromise is well known to us all. But we cannot forget what the legislature did with respect to patients' rights. With respect to patients' rights, they said that's not good enough. They specifically named, included sheltered employment was within the definition of a service to be provided to the disabled, and then they provided robust remedies doesn't adequately describe it. They provided a statute with unusual remedies, which would be intended to prevent exactly this harm, in which this case proves is essential to protect the disabled, those least favored among us, those most easily forgotten. If I'm wrong, then what happens is this. Anytime there is a potential patient's rights claim, the employer, by reverse application, goes into the work comp system and generates a remedy, which they can do.
But, Counselor, in order to buy your argument, I have to conclude that the employer is something more than an employer. And I understand you may not like the case law and dual persona, but there has to be some basis for liability for the employer. Otherwise, if the employer doesn't have some other quality here because of providing services to someone who is disabled, then any time somebody has pain and suffering that's not compensated under workers' comp, we would get a claim saying we're going to sue the employer for this. And that's not what our law says at all. It says it's the exclusive remedy. And even though it may not be provided in what you get itemization by itemization in workers' comp, either from a hearing or through a stipulation, that is the law. We say it's the exclusive remedy. So I want you to explain to me if this employer is not something more than an employer under Chapter 51, why do they have this obligation?
Because there are statutes under which the exclusive remedy does not bar. Three have been found by the court so far, the WFEA for one,
okay,
the Wisconsin Privacy Statutes by the Eastern District Federal Court in Milwaukee, and this one by the Court of Appeals. And I submit that the importance of recognizing the rights of these other groups is most compelling and most important with respect to the disabled, far more compelling than those with claims under the WFEA.
Okay, so what you're saying then is that you're not arguing dual persona. You're arguing that this statute is an exception to the exclusive remedy of workers' comp.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
And the Byers case sets that forth very clearly, and the Byers analysis was adopted by the Court of Appeals.
Could I ask you, Curtis's mother received a payment here. What was the theory for that payment?
That was, I believe, for payment of medical bills.
That's on 130,
AP 132. AP 132, Justice?
It's the top. There's the page that has the attorney's fees, and then the top of the next page.
I believe that was everything after reimbursement to me for my out-of-pocket expenses and my approved attorney's fees. Everything else went to Paulette, who is the guardian of Curtis.
So is there any negligence theory related to the payments to Curtis's mother?
Any negligence?
Yeah.
I don't understand, Justice.
Well, in essence, you alleged negligence at one point on the part of the center. And that did result in some consequences to Curtis's mother. I mean, he was yes, abusive to his mother, and there was damage at home and that sort of thing.
Yes.
But the payment was unrelated to any such theory, is that right?
Yes, Judge, her claim, Justice, her claim is still pending in the trial court. This was paid to her as guardian of Curtis.
Is he a Chapter 55?
I'm sorry, Justice.
I should speak more loudly. Is he a Chapter 55? If it was paid, as Justice Prosser indicates, to Paulette Kelchin as legal guardian of Curtis, I assume there's a guardianship that's been established because of that. Is that correct?
Yes. I do not know if there's a Chapter 55. It may not be necessary because Paulette is his full-time caretaker. Therefore, they don't require services of Chapter 55 board. So it may very well be there is no 55 action involved because of her, the extent of her involvement caring for Curtis.
Now, again, going back to this agreement about the $10,000, there's a whole long laundry list of what's covered, and then it winds up in any other compensation, past, present, or future, under workers' comp. Any obvious worker comp benefits left out of that laundry list, or is it just a total one?
No. The intent was to compromise all of it. And on this continuing questions, I would also point out that there is case law, La Crosse Lutheran, that a compromise agreement is a finding of no liability under the Work Comp Act. What we have here is an agreement which was specifically limited to compromising work comp claims only, and which under case law is deemed to be a finding of no liability. So what we attempted to do there is to wrap up whatever claims there were under the Work Comp Act, even though it was over our objection, not having wanted to be there in the first place, and now proceed to enforce the rights under the Patients' Rights Act, which for make-whole damages.
And how much are those under your complaint? Go ahead.
We haven't put a figure on it. I believe they'll be substantial. My client has PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, on a permanent basis. I believe the exemplary damages, when all of the facts will be laid before the jury, will be very substantial. This is a case of outrageous neglect, an outrageous violation of patients' rights, as I described in my very brief summary of some of those facts, and I believe a jury will take it very seriously. And it's exactly what needs to be done to vindicate patients' rights.
Counsel, as I understand double recovery, it's based on equitable jurisprudence, and that is to prevent unjust enrichment. Now, your client as received by the mother got a little over $6,500 in the workers' comp claim.
Yes.
And maybe I should ask your opposing party counsel, but I just failed to see how your client was unjustly enriched.
He hasn't been, and the Court of Appeals, in my opinion, misapplied badly the rule against double recovery. In its decision on the point, it cited no authority. And the law on the rule against double recovery and its purpose is very clear. And in that regard, the Court of Appeals decision does great mischief to an area of the law which had been very clear. In fact, there is no unjust enrichment, and that is the purpose of the rule against double recovery. The way to handle it in the trial court is the statute allows us to recover any damages as may be proved. We propose we prove our damages to a jury, and if we recover every bit of those damages, there should be an offset for a previous recovery. So we make our made whole and no more, which is all we see, which is what the patient's rights statute is all about. It's why the legislature wrote it as it did.
Your red light is on. Time moves quickly here when you're having fun.
Yeah.
Counsel, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal, Mr. Todrick. Thank you. My understanding is the next 30 minutes will be divided between Mr. Peterson of LaFollette, Godfrey & Kahn, representing Warsaw Insurance, and Attorney Ritchie of Misfeld Stark et al., representing St. Paul Fire and Marine. Okay? Counsel?
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Jim Peterson of LaFollette, Godfrey & Kahn. With my co-counsel, Mr. Robert Drefs, we represent Wausau Insurance Companies. Wausau is one of the providers of workers' compensation insurance to the Career Development Center, the sheltered workshop where Mr. Kelchin was employed. Also arguing today will be Mr. John Ritchie, who represents the Career Development Center and the St. Paul Insurance Companies. St. Paul provides general liability coverage to the Career Development Center. Also present today is the attorney, Jim Pelish, who represents Venture Insurance Company. Venture is the second provider of employment workers' compensation insurance to the Career Development Center. Our arguments today, like our briefs, are presented on behalf of the Career Development Center and all of its insurers. This case presents two fundamental issues, the first of which is whether the patient's Bill of Rights applies to the CDC and to Mr. Kelchin's assaults. When I'm finished, Mr. Ritchie will argue that the patient's Bill of Rights, 5161 of the statutes, does not apply at all to this situation. I will address the second fundamental issue, which is whether the remedies in the patient's Bill of Rights supersede the exclusive remedy provision of the Workers' Compensation Act. We agree with opposing counsel that this Court's decision in Byers versus Lurk provides the analytical framework that this Court must use to reconcile the apparent conflict between the Patient's Bill of Rights and the Workers' Compensation Act. But there are three crucial distinctions that require this Court to reach the opposite conclusion than that it reached in the Byers case. And those crucial distinctions are, first, unlike the Fair Employment Act, the Patient's Bill of Rights does not directly regulate employment at all. Second, the application of the exclusive remedy provision, according to this Court's analysis in Byers, would have effectively abrogated the Fair Employment Act. The application of the exclusive remedy provision to the Patient's Bill of Rights would not effectively abrogate the Patient's Bill of Rights. In fact, it would leave it largely untouched. At best, this claim is marginal to the Patient's Bill of Rights, which, again, does not regulate employment specifically. Finally, the third distinction is that the failure to apply the exclusive remedy provision of the Workers' Compensation Act in this case would undermine the coverage of the Workers' Compensation Act to sheltered employment. At the end of the day, Mr. Kelchin is seeking a remedy in this Court that would effectively withdraw the protections of the Workers' Compensation Act to providers of sheltered employment. The legislature did not intend this result by enacting the Patient's Bill of Rights, and in fact, this result would be contrary to the stated policies of the legislature. To put it simply, the legislature wants to make employing the disabled easier, not harder. And by withdrawing the protections afforded to the employer under the Workers' Compensation Act to the providers of sheltered employers, this Court would be imposing a barrier on the employment of the disabled in sheltered workers.
Mr. Peterson, obviously you're taking the position that the Court of Appeals got it wrong in regard to exclusive remedy. Is that correct?
Clearly, we're not objecting to the conclusion of the Court of Appeals, but the Court of Appeals analysis could be improved because it doesn't track the Byers analytical framework. The analysis of the Court of Appeals was incomplete. The Court of Appeals began, as this Court did in Byers, by examining the purposes of the two acts, Patient's Bill of Rights and the Workers' Compensation Act.
But the bottom line is you feel they got it wrong in regard to exclusive remedy.
That's right. The answer is right. The reasons are wrong on
but
exclusive remedy.
What's your position in regard to double recovery? What do you think about their position in that regard? Did they get it right or wrong?
The Court of Appeals' decision on double recovery was rooted in its recognition that it had to preserve the exclusive remedy provision that was built into the Workers' Compensation Act. It construed the Patient's Bill of Rights to permit the facts alleged here to state a claim under one section of the patient's Bill of Rights, but it recognized that it would be eviscerating workers' compensation if it were to allow Mr. Kelchin to recover under the patient's Bill of Rights precisely those damages which are excluded under the Workers' Compensation Act. And if I may, I can pick up the line of questions related to the double recovery issue.
Let me finish for a minute.
Please.
When you're talking about double recovery and how the Court of Appeals approached it, are you relying at all on the compromise agreement and the language in the compromise agreement?
Yes, to the extent that we think if this court seeks to affirm the Court of Appeals on the same reasoning, the compromise agreement is crucial. The compromise agreement makes very clear that what is compromised is all possible remedies under workers' compensation. The Court of Appeals said, although workers' compensation does not allow pain and suffering as an itemized, separately itemized recovery under workers' compensation, the worker's pain and suffering is a component of the recovery insofar as it affects medical expenses and it impacts future earnings. The compromise agreement here is a complete compromise of everything that could have been recovered under workers' compensation. The most fundamental issue is that
there is no payment per se.
It's not separate. It is not separately itemized, but
so if this was a straight tort action, there'd be future meds would be estimated on the basis of what might be expected because of physical or mental injury or whatever. There'd be past meds on both, but then there'd be a line pain and suffering. You don't have that kind of line in workers' comp.
There's no separate line, although this Court's cases in Swiss Colony and in Threshermans recognize that pain is a component of the recovery in workers' compensation. There's no dispute here, though,
okay,
that workers' compensation, the separate recovery for pain and suffering was precisely what was given up in exchange for the balance
with
in
certainty.
Workers' compensation. That's exactly right.
Let me look at that then again. Did you draft this who drafted this compromise agreement?
I don't know who drafted the compromise agreement.
Did the did counsel for Kelchin draft it? Do you know that?
I don't believe that counsel for Kelchin drafted the agreement.
Okay.
Workers' comp drafted.
I do not know who was the drafter of it.
It says that the specific claim, and again, if we had an application, we'd know, we'd have that in front of us. It says that specifically that there was a claim for past medical expenses, temporary total disability, and I'm reading from Appendix 130, top of the page. Temporary total disability benefits for a period of August 29th, 95 through March 11th, 1996, together with future medical expenses. Do you have any reason to dispute the accuracy of that?
I have no reason to dispute the accuracy of that. Is that the second part of paragraph 4 that you're looking at?
That's correct, counsel.
No reason to dispute the accuracy of that. I believe that in Mr. Kelchin's brief, he concluded that or stated that these amounts here represent a reasonable estimate of the actual past treatment costs, future treatment costs, and lost wages.
And that's what he claimed according to this document. Specifically, the employee alleges entitlement to TTD together with future medical, because past medical apparently was paid the amount of $4,000+. So that's what he's claimed in workers' comp. Now, if you go to page 4 of this agreement, there's language that, for want of a better phrase, is a laundry list that encompasses
yes.
everything. For instance, it compromises any future claim, I arguably, that he may have with regard to mileage expenses. Was there any claim for mileage expenses made in this workers' comp case?
I don't know whether there was a separate itemization of mileage expenses as part of the medical expenses.
Okay. Fair enough, although it indicates medical expenses. It doesn't say mileage. Well, that's fair enough. Was there any claim for a 10235 in this case that's for bad faith, penalties for bad faith and delayed payments?
No, I don't believe so.
But that was given up here as part of any future claim that might be made. Is that right? Any future claim that was made for retraining and rehabilitation benefits and expenses, that was also given up. Is that right?
That was given up. My understanding is that there were $4,100 in past treatment costs, $317 in wages. The remainder of it was for future treatment. Whether that was future medical treatment or future vocational rehabilitation, I don't know.
So the claims, at least your understanding of this, the claims that are set forth on page 4B are for future claims potential future claims. I mean, there's no idea that he's really going to make claim for mileage expense or penalty for bad faith or for retraining or claim for delayed payments. None of that is really asserted. This is just a laundry list of all things that potentially could be asserted under Chapter 102. Is that right?
Yes.
But what he did claim was past medical, future medical, and wage loss. Is that correct?
Yes.
Is it your position that there's any pain and suffering component to wage loss under workers' compensation?
Yes.
And where do you find that?
It's not in the claim. It's in the law of Threshermans, a Swiss colony, that to the extent that pain and suffering affects a worker's future earnings and requires medical treatment, it is compensated.
But there was no claim for future earning loss of capacity. I mean, I'll give you Swiss colony, you know, there a workplace injury where there was above and beyond the amount of harassment maybe at the workplace, emotional distress, and there was a claim that it affected the future loss of earning capacity and therefore entitlement to a permanent disability. There's no claim made here.
That is exactly right, Your
Honor. For any permanent disability.
That is exactly correct.
There was no claim made here for delayed payments.
That's correct,
right?
Too.
Okay. And nevertheless, your position that the money that was paid for something other than what the claim was made for.
It was paid for everything that could have been compensated under workers' compensation. The long laundry list that you describe are illustrative examples. The beginning of paragraph B says, any workers' compensation recovery arising from these incidents. And then those itemized lists are illustrative.
Counsel, let me ask you a question in a more hypothetical way about pain and suffering. If a worker breaks his leg and he's out of work for 6 weeks, he can claim, if it's a work-related injury, compensation for that period when he's without employment. If the same worker at work is burned, say he works with hot liquids and he got scalded because a retort opened and boiling water came out on him, he's out for 6 weeks. The pain and suffering of those two injuries is extremely different. As we all know, third-degree burns are some of the most painful injuries where a broken leg hurts, but once the doc takes care of you and it starts to heal, you have some healing time, but you're not in pain on a constant basis. Yet workers' comp would compensate for those two injuries in the same way, correct?
That is exactly right.
Yeah.
And every worker in this state works under those terms when they are covered by workers' compensation.
Yeah, I'm not arguing with that premise, but I think that you know, where the sort of weasel words, as I call them, come in is that pain and suffering is accounted for to the extent it affects earnings. And to the extent it affects earnings is how long you're not able to earn. So some injuries hurt you a whole lot and some don't hurt you a whole lot, and the compensation is exactly the same.
That's exactly right. Our position is not that somehow in this $10,000 workers' compensation award, Mr. Kelchin actually got compensation for the extent of his pain and suffering. Our position is rather this, that it is up to the legislature to decide what compensation an injured worker gets. And the legislature has decided, as part of the historic compromise that this Court has recognized for nearly 100 years, that it is the policy of this state that compensation for pain and suffering purely is not recoverable under workers' compensation. We are not trying to suggest somehow that Mr. Kelchin really got his pain and suffering. Our suggestion is, rather, that that is a question for the legislature to decide, and the legislature has decided that in absolutely crystal clear terms in 102.03 sub 3, and that it did, the legislature did not intend, by the enactment of the Patient's Bill of Rights, which does not expressly address the employment situation at all, to upset that fundamental balance of interests. If this Court is to find that the Patient's Bill of Rights restricts the application of the exclusive remedy provision, it must do the kind of analysis that it has done in Byers. And that analysis shows that the court, the legislature, did not intend to upset that balance. I see my time has expired.
I have a question. So where did the Court of Appeals go wrong in applying Byers? Do that very quickly, please.
Very quickly, in three ways. First, because the legislature specifically enacted a comprehensive remedial scheme directed specifically at employment in the Fair Employment Act, it was not a stretch. In fact, it was the only reasonable conclusion that the legislature intended to regulate employment specifically. Second, this Court in Byers recognized that if the exclusive remedy provision were applied to fair employment claims of discrimination and employment discrimination, the most egregious examples of workplace discrimination would be subject to the limitation, because only the most egregious examples would fall into the workers' compensation coverage. And finally, the Court implicitly recognized or explicitly recognized that in Byers, in, with fair employment, the overlap is really very infrequent. It doesn't happen very often. Here, what is the effect of Mr. Kelchin's request is that sheltered employment, sheltered employers wouldn't be totally stripped of the benefits of the protections of the Workers' Compensation Act. For that reason, the exclusive remedy should bar any claim against an employer by an injured employee under the Patient's Bill of Rights.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Ritchie, representing St. Paul Fire and Marine Insurance Company.
Good morning. My name is John Ritchie from the law firm of Ritchie, Wickstrom & Wax in Eau Claire, and I do represent the Career Development Center and St. Paul Fire and Marine Insurance Company, its general liability carrier. The topic that I would like to talk to you about this morning is actually the applicability of the patient's rights statute at all. The arguments that have been made by Mr. Todrick essentially assume that the statute applies and that because something happened at the Career Development Center that it automatically applies and that automatically somehow a patient's right has been violated. If we take a look at that statute in the context of the entire Chapter 51 and the history behind that statute, I think the exact opposite result is drawn from that. The problem in interpreting this statute seems to arise from the introductory paragraph that defines a patient as anybody who is receiving services for mental illness, developmental disabilities, alcoholism, drug addiction, and then has the word including. And the word including is then followed by a laundry list of categories of persons that would be patients under that statute. And there's a fundamental difference of interpretation here as to what's meant by the word including. Is that list an exclusive list as to what is included as a patient, or is that list just a representative example of what is a patient? This Supreme Court has addressed what is meant by the word including when you're looking at statutory interpretation. In the case of Milwaukee Gas Light Company versus Wisconsin Department of Taxation, which is 127 Northwest 2nd 64, This Court stated that the word including has two acceptable shades of meaning. Number one, that it means the only thing that is included. Or number two, that which follows constitutes only a part or component of the whole. So in essence, it can be used either way. You'd have to read the statute and take the whole thing in context to figure out what the legislature intended in this instance. It is our interpretation that when you look at the patient's rights statute, where it came from and how it's drafted, that it applies to people who are committed or admitted under Chapter 51 or the other statutes that are specifically identified, which all deal with people whose liberties are going to be restrained by court order or similar fashion.
Can you please explain to me by whom and under what statutory authority CDC was paid to provide this opportunity for employment?
Well, the county has a contract with the Career Development Center to provide sheltered employment services under 51.437, which is a service which they are entitled to.
Okay, so they are hired under 51.437 to provide services.
Well, there's nothing in the contracts that specifically identify that we're hired under this particular statute. It's just a contract that says we agree to provide these services. So.
But that's your understanding?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
But it does not mean that simply because someone receives services under Chapter 51 that everything under Chapter 51 makes them a patient under the patient's rights statute.
Counsel, did you have an opportunity in the amicus brief? One of the things they cited was the commentary to HFS 94.04. Did you have an opportunity to look at that commentary with regard to 5161 and notification of the rights and a commentary which indicates that the rights, some of the rights may be more applicable to patients inpatient other than to those in less restrictive facilities such as sheltered workshops or outpatient clinics?
Well, I've seen that. I don't recall.
How do you respond, if you want, how do you respond to the department's interpretation of the notification of rights procedure and those encompassed within the requirement?
Well, first of all, that's just a commentary. Whoever drafted it is not, it's not part of the administrative code itself, and it's not part of the statute. So we have to deal with the language of the statute. But there is sheltered employment possibilities where people can have sheltered employment when they're placed under Chapter 55, where sheltered employment can be part of the treatment program. And there are specific patients' rights then that deal with what you do with someone who is in a protective placement where sheltered employment may be part of the treatment program. The second patient's right listed specifically talks about what happens when you're in therapeutic employment as part of the placement. But we're talking about something entirely different. We're talking about an individual who's not committed under Chapter 51, who is not placed under Chapter 55. It's just somebody who was looking for services and was placed there. So when we look at the patient's rights statute in its context, in the entirety of it, if you take it, the list of groups under a patient, each one of those that the legislature identified is somebody who is committed or admitted or otherwise detained, which is consistent with the way the statute previously was worded, because originally it only applied to people who were committed under Chapter 51. The problem when this was created in 1975, the only people who had patients' rights were those who were committed under Chapter 51. People could be committed under different statutes, but they didn't come under the patients' rights statute. That's why in the next legislative session, the legislature redrafted it to bring in those people who are committed under other statutes, which are those that are listed in that introductory paragraph.
As I read the legislative history, it started out, as you indicated, rather narrow, and then they, one of the drafts, sent it to the Center for Public Representation, and the definition got expanded a bit with regard to those who are covered after they tracked the recommendation of the Center of Public Representation. Is that your recollection of the legislative history?
Well, the part that we had put in our brief as the
That was
in our appendix. It was
draft four.
Yes.
Yeah. There were several more drafts after that.
Yes. So the long and the short of it is that you had originally patients who, before 1975, had no patients' rights, and the only protections they had from being abused was a criminal statute that made it a crime for health care providers to abuse the patients. In 1975, they created the patients' rights statute to protect people under 51. But there are people right next to them who are there committed under different statutes, and they, in theory, wouldn't have the same protections, which didn't make any sense.
Do I understand, counsel, in your argument that really the linchpin or a primary foundation of your argument that this person is not a patient rests on the includes but is not limited to language?
Yes. Well, it just says including.
Including. I mean, your argument is that it used to say including but not limited to. And your argument is because they took out but not limited to, it's a restrictive, more a narrow definition.
No. It used to say this applies to people who are committed under this chapter. And this chapter meaning 51.
That's the very beginning. But once they added including but not limited to.
I don't think they ever said including but not limited to. They just said.
That's in draft six.
Oh, that you probably had seen something I couldn't read because if they took that out, it would seem to be more indicative that it is an exclusive list.
Have you ever checked the bill drafting manual to see how the word including is used in bill drafting?
I have not. I just went back to the case law.
I have, I think, the bill drafting manual. It says, do not use include but is not limited to. That phrase is redundant. That seems to be, if they followed the bill drafting manual, who knows if they did, that would undermine your argument, it seems to me.
If this was drafted in 1975, at about the same time that Wisconsin Department of Taxation case talked about how we look at the word including, and you've got to look in the statute, look at the overall statute, because if you're giving a laundry list of examples, then why would the legislature list as examples only people who are committed and held against their will, if they really mean that it includes everybody who may just go in to see their counselor because they are suffering from depression. The second thing is, if you take a look at how the statute itself is worded under the patient's rights statute, the very first right that a patient has is under A, upon admission or commitment to be informed orally and in writing of their rights under this section. If the legislature intended to give these rights to everyone, then why would the legislature say that the provider is subject to providing all of these rights, but you don't have to tell them about it unless they're committed? Only those who are committed need to be informed. That would not make any sense. Instead, what that tells us, looking from paragraph A, would suggest that it's because this statute deals only with people who are committed or admitted, maybe under Chapter 51, but now that it's been expanded, it includes people under 55 or all of the criminal statutes where they can be committed or held against their will.
So it's your position that if someone provides care or treatment for someone who is mentally handicapped, and they receive money for the county to do that, that they don't have any obligations any different than they would have to the employment of you or I, were that to be the circumstances.
Well, you may have liabilities that arise, but it's not going to be under the patient's rights statute.
Well, if they're the employer and workers' comp is the exclusive remedy, where else would I go to look?
Well, you're talking about somebody who's a residential care provider. You may have tort claims against them, but it's not going to be under the patient's rights statute.
Right, but if they're also listed as your employer, which is the circumstance we have here, tell me where there would be relief for this man.
For this man, the relief, because this is an employer, I mean, this is a factory where they're making mattresses and springs for Happy Sleeper and putting labels on bottles and whatnot. It is an employer, and it's run as a factory. So if people put a staple in their hand or they slip on oil and break their leg, they're going to have workers' compensation. Remember, the worker right next to him may be there because he suffers from alcoholism or because he's a drug addict. All of people who are entitled to services under Chapter 51, it's not just necessarily developmentally disabled.
Do those people also, now this individual got, I think, $20, as I understand it, about $20 a week in payment, and for the relevant period in 1995, it never made more than $100 a month. Is that right?
Well, I can't say that's right or wrong. That, if counsel has represented that as being accurate, I assume that it is.
Well, the settlement, the compromise agreement, gives it a $20 and some odd cents.
Right,
for
right.
Does he get, do they take off Social Security payments? I mean, is it treated with a W-2 as wages?
I believe it is, but I can't swear to it.
Well, in fact, as I understand Social Security law, which is, not in depth, that if you were trying to get a Social Security disability, which is a hard disability to get, and you had someone that was working at a sheltered workshop, that Social Security does not consider sheltered workshop as even constituting employment for purposes of getting a disability under Social Security. Do you know that one way or the other? That was set forth
in
one of the briefs.
That would be a collateral issue because it's not necessarily the same as workers' compensation.
No, my point is as to whether or not this is really employment. I'm saying even for Social Security disability purposes, someone could work morning, noon, and night at a sheltered workshop. It is set forth in the briefs and someone's argument, and that they don't consider that employment for someone who's trying to get 100% disability under Social
Fair enough.
Security.
That would go to, though, the issue as to whether or not workers' compensation applies. And if you said workers' comp should not apply, that Kelchin should have fought that claim, I would still be here saying, even if that was the case, it doesn't make him a patient under the patient's rights statute.
Well, let's get back to that. 5161 paren 1 says, in this section, patient means any individual who's receiving services for mental illness, developmental disabilities, et cetera. Does he fit under mental illness or developmental disabilities?
Yes.
Okay. Is he receiving services?
In this, it doesn't define what services
it does,
is.
It does in 51.437.
Right.
One. And it says in this section, services means, and it says sheltered employment.
Right.
So why isn't he a patient?
Because it goes on to say including, and then it lists only people who are committed or admitted against where their personal liberties can now be restrained, where they cannot simply walk away and say, I don't want it and I don't like it.
Is that your best argument among all the four hurdles you have to overcome? Patience, is that where you're putting all your eggs in that basket?
Well, I'm putting my eggs in the basket in the fact that you have to come within that list, and he does not. But the second part of the argument that hasn't been addressed yet is, what patient right are you claiming? If you're a patient, then what right was violated? Because the administrative code lists a whole list of things that are considered services that are provided under Chapter 51. It doesn't say in the patient's rights statute that you have safety in sheltered employment. What he's trying to argue is that he was, at least in the lower courts, that he was deprived of educational opportunities, which education is defined in the administrative code as something entirely different.
What is it defined as, counsel?
It is defined as education and training, education and diagnostic services or treatment services. Treatment services are defined as medical or medically related services. Treatment services, I'm reading from HFS 61.39. Treatment services provide coordinated medical or medically related interventions which halt, control, or reverse processes which cause, aggravate, or complicate developmental disabilities. The interventions may include dental and medical treatments, physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, and other medical and ancillary medical programs. This is not medical. This is somebody who has a job. He's just working in a factory. And what we've done in this case is that Kelchin is looking for an avenue to make a substantial recovery. Well, and even though there isn't anything that deals with it, we take the closest thing.
Chief, if I may. Counsel, you make reference to HFS 6139 for the proposition that he's got a job, he's working in a factory. How about the very next section, 61.40, sheltered employment?
Right.
Sheltered employment services are non-competitive, remunerative employment for an indefinite period of time for individuals who are presently unemployable in a competitive labor market. And then it goes on to work activity services are work-like therapeutic activities for handicapped persons.
You may have somebody who, there are certain intrinsic values for anybody to be able to get up in the morning and get themselves to the Career Development Center so they can say that they have a job and whatnot. But we are not treating anything. We are not treating autism. We are not trying to make it better. And the statute, when he's looking under the patient's rights statute, is a claim where the CDC has deprived him, has provided inappropriate or inadequate treatment. Here, there's been no claim that they've done anything about the sheltered employment. What they're saying is that he was assaulted on their premises. Well, and that's unfortunate, but that's not one of the patient's rights. When we look at the Erbstozer case, for example, somebody was injured too. When Erbstozer was somebody who was injured while she was locked up on a mental commitment. And they said, yeah, recreational walk, though, doesn't, that's not part of the treatment program. So even though they may be negligent for having a slippery sidewalk and you got hurt, it doesn't give rise to a patient's rights claim. If you can sue them in tort, go ahead and try. Malpractice, go ahead and try, but it's not a patient's rights statute. Here, we don't have a patient's rights statute claim. If there is any other avenue for him to go after, go ahead and try it. You know, it may be blocked by workers' compensation as being the exclusive remedy, but that doesn't mean that it's blocked. It can somehow then come back to the patient's rights statute and get something that you otherwise wouldn't.
Mr. Ritchie, your opposing counsel referred to the center's outrageous neglect. What deterrent is there for the employees of at a sheltered workshop not to continue to disregard the interests of the employees if you say that this act doesn't apply at all?
Well, it would be no different than anybody else who is an employer who might have the same kind of concerns for their employees. No one is going to, if you take it out of the realm of sheltered employment and you just made the same claim with anybody else, you'd say, what's the deterrent? Well, the deterrent is that people may stop working there. The county may choose not to subsidize any more employment. And they're going to pay damages under workers' compensation just as any other employer would.
But Counselor, when they accept payments to run a sheltered workshop, don't they assume a little bit more responsibility for the people that are there than you would assume if you were a regular employer?
Well, but the question becomes, does that somehow mean that the Chapter 5161 statute applies? They're subsidized because if they were not subsidized, it would be economically unfeasible for these people to have this opportunity.
Oh, yeah, I understand exactly why they're subsidized. And that's not, but they take that subsidization with the idea they will employ these people, but they will also make a profit on it. I mean, they're not doing this for free. They're doing it under a contract to make money, right?
Well,
and so they don't. Well, they don't pay these people a lot. They're probably not overly productive, but they do receive. They do receive a profit on running this operation.
Yes, they do.
Okay, and the operation is to take care of people that are vulnerable, at least in some cases.
Well, it is the job is to provide a service, which is the sheltered employment service, no doubt. That's a service that is provided under Chapter 51. But somehow we're saying because it's provided under Chapter 51, that automatically makes the patient's rights statute applicable. And that's clearly not true because transportation is also a service that they're afforded under Chapter 51. And this court, or the plenty of cases where the courts have said, yeah, but that you have to be checked into a treatment facility before it becomes applicable. There are all the cases that we talk about saying the statute doesn't kick in until you've been admitted or committed. Then we have the bright line as to when the statute applies and when it does not apply.
Thank you.
The odd thing on all of this, which wasn't raised by anybody in this case, is that the statute is worded very unusual because the remedies allow punitive damages, which are, if you intentionally ignore someone's rights, your damages are capped at $1,000 for exemplary damages. But if it's negligently ignored, there is no cap. All I can say is it's a difficult statute to interpret because I don't know what everybody was thinking when they drafted it, but I do think that this is really intended to just extend the protections that were originally for people who are committed only under Chapter 51, now for everybody who's committed.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Todrick, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
May it please the Court. I want to get back to one point of concerning Mr. Peterson's remarks. It is true that there is very little that the two statutes have in common. This statute doesn't regulate work. In Byers, you had two statutes that did regulate work. This one does not. That makes the Byers analysis even more compelling. It's impossible for a statute intended to regulate work, it's impossible that that statute can carry out the important functions of this patient's rights statute, which is why the exclusive remedy must not be applied to bar claims under the statute. It is incorrect that it's hinted throughout the briefs and the arguments that a dam will burst and claims will be brought under this statute to overrun the protections of the Work Comp Act. That's not true. Erbstorzer was cited by both sides. Erbstorzer puts limitations on the extent to which patients' rights under sub 1, sub F can be used. And this case fits squarely within sub 1, sub F. This is a case when comparing the two statutes, the work comp statute and the patient's rights, clearly the work comp statute provides limited benefits. It's also clear that the patient's rights statute vindicates, is intended to vindicate the rights of the most vulnerable and provides make-whole damages. That's why double recovery can only be measured by whether my client's made whole. The legislature did make clear when it wrote the patient's rights statute, long after it wrote the Work Comp Act. When it created this statute, it already knew about the Grand Compromise. It already knew about its importance, but it wrote this statute anyway to protect the most vulnerable among us. With respect to Mr. Ritchie's arguments, this statute is not ambiguous. It's clear as a bell. Additionally, I disagree with counsel that my client does not fit within any of the categories after the word including. He is receiving care or treatment through a department or county department and in a private treatment facility. This ties to the point in my brief that this is treatment. And I'm going to end on this.
Counselor, I maybe misunderstood you. Looking at 5161.1, you're saying that after the word including, nothing else in that statute applies to your client?
No, just the opposite. That was counsel's position.
Okay.
I'm submitting there are some of those which does apply to my client.
So are you arguing that he is one, quote, who is receiving care or treatment for those conditions through the Department of County under
yes.
Sections 5142 or 51437?
Yes.
Okay.
And also in a private treatment facility, and this is all set forth in my brief. I just want to remind the Court that I don't agree and do not accept these arguments of counsel. Lastly, on legislative history. Legislative history also does not support their position. In 1975, the legislature adopted the definition of developmental disability services and included sheltered employment in 1975. In 1977, 2 years later, they adopted the broad meaning of a patient
and specifically referenced anyone receiving services for developmental disabilities. And in that same year of 77, they adopted 5507, which applies to people receiving services under 55, and make it clear as a bell that under anyone receiving services there, whether on a voluntary or an involuntary basis, have all the rights provided under 51.61. I tried to set forth my position on legislative history in my brief, and I think I did, and I urge the court to refer to it. I just want to, again, remind that I dispute and disagree with counsel's position on those matters.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any further questions for Mr. Todrick? Hearing none, Mr. Todrick, that concludes our argument in 02-1249, St. Paul Fire and Insurance, Marine Insurance Company versus Curtis J. Keldon. And I want to thank all counsel for a vigorous argument and an interesting one this morning on a statutory interpretation issue. We will take a few moments in recess so that the students may leave. And we will then return. I remind you all, you're welcome to return after the